The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library. My name is Mimi Robertson, and I am a proud supporter of the Free Library. Tonight's event is the Julie Dannenbaum Memorial Culinary Arts Lecture, which was established in honor of my mother. It was here in Philadelphia she lived, established her creative cooking school, and wrote 5 cookbooks. Before Raymond Sokoloff takes the stage, I'd like to encourage you to explore the Julie Dannenbaum Culinary Arts Collection here on Parkway Central. If you are inspired by tonight's lecture, you can get cooking with the collection, which features everything from wine guides and cookie recipes to French cuisine cookbooks and bread baking manuals. To support the library, including our growing culinary arts collection, through the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation, please visit freelibrary.org/support. Now on to tonight's event. Distinguished restaurant critic and columnist Raymond Sokoloff began his career as a foreign correspondent at Newsweek in 1965, where he thoughtfully rendered his first French meal in writing. He became restaurant critic of the New York Times in 1973, paying a careful attention to restaurant lore, decor, and politics. Sokoloff was also a founding editor of the Daily Leisure and Arts section at the Wall Street Journal. He is the author of The Saucier's Apprentice and numerous other food books, as well as Native Intelligence, a novel, and Wayward Reporter, a biography of A.J. Liebling. In Steal the Menu, tonight's book, he traces the American food scene from Julia Child's opus, Mastering the Art of French Cooking, through today's flourishing and diverse culinary world. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Raymond Sokoloff.
Thank you, Mimi. It's such a privilege to be here for two reasons that come to mind immediately. One is in the memory of Julie Dannenbaum. Mimi's mother was a great pioneering figure in the world of food culture, really, the dissemination of important good ideas about cooking and demonstrating how to do it. And also to be in this wonderful institution. I've just been sitting in a room with and in this series of authors, I've just been sitting in a small room with their pictures, and it has been a humbling experience to follow after Mario Vargas Llosa and Kurt Vonnegut and a whole other group of people whom we have all read with pleasure. I'm here tonight because of an accident that occurred to me when I was fairly young that changed my life. I had basically trained to be a professor of Greek and Latin, and it came to me fairly far into this mistaken plan that it was a very, very bad idea for me, and I salvaged what I could. I became a journalist. It was a time of optimism and indulgence for young people in journalism, and journalism itself was in a good state in the middle and late 60s, and I was able to work for Newsweek in France, and then came to New York, and as I was approaching my 30s, I thought, well, this is not exactly happening either. So, and at that precise moment, through a series of accidents, someone with no training at all in cooking or the world of food ended up in one of the biggest jobs in the field. I became the food editor of the New York Times in 1971. Now, their mistake in hiring me was my very good luck, because although I had information and I had also been in the presence of greatness. When I was a graduate student at Harvard, I lived on the same street as Julia Child, and we never met. And although frequently we took the same bus, and I did cook from her book. That is true, and I think I achieved a reasonable standard doing it. And we also shared a butcher. And in my book, there is a picture taken for Life magazine by Lee Lockwood of Julia with Jack Savinor, this butcher, who was later indicted for false weighting the meat. What he did, he did not put, if I remember correctly, Jack did not put his hand on the scale. He weighed the container that the meat was in, and so there was always a sort of, you know, a 6 or 7 ounces of additional weight that you were being charged. And so this, the fact that Julia went along with this or never uncovered it herself did not diminish my respect for her. On the other hand, I was too shy to go up to her in the shop and say, you know, what I knew other dozens of other people had done. I said, oh, I really loved your recipe for cassoulet, Mrs. Child. And then, you know, she would have to be polite, and it would. So I never did that. But I had been in her presence, and when I worked for Newsweek, I had, because my boss, a charmless fellow who really didn't like me, he had to grit his teeth and let me go to cover the bestowal of the third Michelin star on a restaurant in Alsace. We had advance warning of this, but he had to go cover some ephemeral political event. And so I got the assignment, and I was there. And that's when it occurred to me that this would be a very nice life. And but I didn't do anything about it until I got hired through the machinations of colleagues of mine. And I'm suddenly in the middle of this world where, in those days, being the restaurant critic of the New York Times was a major deal. You could mobilize. People would line up to eat in places that I said were interesting, and I could create panic in the streets with a 700 word review, and it was a distorting thing for a young person, and I'm not sure it was good for my soul, but. And it was a very bad time to be a critic, at least in the beginning, because President Nixon had instituted wage and price controls, which had a really bad effect on the investment in the restaurant business. And at the same time, many of the old favorite restaurants, like the Café Chauvron, were closing. Now, the Times wanted me to sound as though this was a great tragedy, but I had no investment in the glories of the past, because I'd never eaten in these places during their heyday, and I tended to think, as a veteran correspondent from France, that it was really kind of a crock. The whole New York restaurant scene seemed to me kind of a snobbish bit of fakery, and indeed, my real theme throughout all this is that we were, in those days when I started, in a world of real mediocrity and provinciality in this country in terms of great food. Great food was something you ate in other countries, not here. And the general food culture, as exemplified by supermarkets and certainly by food in restaurants in many other cities across the country, was really kind of dismal compared to what even somebody traveling in Europe on $5 a day, which I had done as a student, you knew that this was a backwater. And there was tremendous, and one of the things that Julia started was the creation of authentic recipes that people could actually do and which would recreate the food that they had eaten during their travels. And this was the beginning of a great era of European travel. So I started out in those days with the idea that mostly everything was really pretty terrible and that you, but then it all began to change. And the way this happened was there was a reason for it, and it's called the Hart-Celler Act of, I think, 1964, which changed the immigration law in a way perhaps more profound even than the law that's under discussion now, because it eliminated a bigoted practice which had been enshrined in the previous immigration law that drastically limited the possibility of immigration for people from Asia. This was typically known as the Chinese Exclusion Act, and that all changed with Hart-Celler, and so that you suddenly had, instead of a completely phony baloney Chinese restaurant scene based on embarrassing what was called Chinese-American food, the chop suey and a whole lot of other things that had been created, totally inauthentic and very bad food that had been created by the descendants of Cantonese rail workers who had been brought in to build the Transcontinental Railroad. But when, after Hart-Celler, large numbers of Chinese, many of them coming in as students, came from all the regions of China and actually knew what food in China was, which was certainly not the case of fifth-generation descendants of Cantonese rail workers who had gradually evolved a corrupt, factitious cuisine in this country. So suddenly you had a whole array of regional Chinese foods, and the most dramatic of them was from Sichuan province. And I had friends who had been in Taiwan, which, you know, we still hadn't recognized China. So Taiwan was the place where you could really learn about all this, because refugees from Mao had settled there from all the regions, and it was and so they had brought their Sichuanese cook. So I really knew something about this. And suddenly there were restaurants all over the place that you could eat in California and in New York and other places. And we had the Sichuan Revolution, which I was able to promote in my way as a rootless cosmopolite in a big newspaper. and then I got sent on Palm Sunday of 1972, I landed in Paris, and with no particular plan, and I was in a taxi accident and somewhat shaken, and got taken to a really weird restaurant by a very unpleasant colleague. And the next day, I ran into someone I'd known at Newsweek who was really plugged in, and he said, you know, you just might be able to get a seat at Michel Gérard's little place in Agnières, which was a really grim little industrial suburb of Paris. The Pot au Feu was his first restaurant, and I, to my mind, he was the most original new chef in France. And the situation was like this. People like me, and I think Julia, had been attracted to the whole idea of French cuisine because we thought it was had evolved slowly like a glacier over the millennia, and there it was, and it would never change. And so those dishes that we had encountered there was a way of doing them, and this was a completely static cultural artifact, French cuisine, and that's the way it was going to be. But that was, of course, completely false, because if you looked at old cookbooks, French cuisine had evolved fairly quickly and dramatically over until World War I. And then, because of a horrible cataclysmic 4 years, the country really was in a terrible state. And then there was a interwar period with a stifling depression, and then World War II, and then a very long post-war recovery, during which the idea of innovation in cooking was not a likely happening. It took a long time, and it evolved into something extremely interesting, and which its practitioners were very careful not to talk too much about. I mean, one of them was a showboat, Paul Bocuse, and he was said a lot of confusing things, as did Gerard, and so no one quite knew what was happening, except if you looked at your plate, something very dramatic was happening, and that's what I discovered in 1972. And this was before anyone had called this phenomenon the nouvelle cuisine, but it was clearly a revolution. And I learned this by accident, because I knew about Bocuse, because my terrible boss, who had had to go cover some political event, who had sent me to Alsace, had also wanted to do a cover story for Newsweek on a new chef called Paul Bocuse. And all he knew was that people were interested in this young chef. So I had made a reservation. I went down there with the photographer, Nisberg, and we saw that something really amazing was going on, that this was way beyond. And I knew I had, my opinion was ratified, because on the train, someone had left a magazine there with Bocuse on the cover, which explained it all. You know, they said there are these young chefs. They all apprenticed for in Vienne for Fernand Point, and they are streamlining old ideas and transforming them, turning them inside out. We would later say deconstructing traditional recipes, having a lot of fun with giving new meanings to old names, and eventually this got to be called nouvelle cuisine, the new kitchen, new cooking. And it spread throughout the world to every traditional cuisine. I have encountered nouvelle Filipino cuisine, in which the perfumed local ingredient ylang-ylang is incorporated into souffles made by with the traditional street food, which is called balut. It's an embryonic a duck egg, and in which if they get more than 18 days old, you can actually see feathers in the egg. And this woman who worked as a cook for Imelda Marcos started a restaurant in the old control tower of the original Manila airport, and it was filled with these dishes which had used French technique to redo things that had been around for a long time as a sort of folk cuisine in the Philippines. And later, when I went with my wife to Peru, we encountered something called Novo Andino cuisine, you know, new Andean cuisine. And so everywhere in the world, this impulse to take what we inherited and turn it into something slightly modern and with a Japanese design flair to it. Well, you've all eaten these things, and it's now commonplace. In fact, when I referred to something, you know, in the 80s, in a letter to M.F.K. Fisher, the California food writer, as nouvelle, she said, "Why do you use that antique term?" She said, "It's just the way we eat now." So So this happened, and I was in this privileged position of seeing it and writing about it first and waiting until it caught on in this country while I then moved into a completely other aspect of this, which was also accidental. I got called up, and I was working as a freelance, and the Natural History Magazine, the publication of then the publication of the American Museum of Natural History, hired me as a food columnist, and the editor decided after a point that he decided after I did a column on cannibalism that I needed direction, and the point of I tried to combine the interest of the museum in cannibalism as a subject in human culture with my gastronomic preoccupations, and I looked in the ethnographic literature to see if I could determine what were the preferred cuts. The fingers actually were again and again cropped up in these. No, the wonderful thing that happened with the Natural History, a serious scientific magazine for the general public. Margaret Mead published a lot of her material there, and other very distinguished scholars. And so when I handed in this thing about cannibalism, they decided this was real ethnography, and they had to have a professional referee. And there was at that time a raging controversy about whether cannibalism had ever happened at all, you know, as a kind of cultural practice. There were people who said that it was really not what we thought, but and it, when it did happen among the Aztecs, cannibalism was a result of a kind of protein shortage, and that's what it was about, and it wasn't some kind of ghoulish thing that people did just because they like to eat other people. So my referee was someone from that who held that point of view, and he was really furious that I was taking this kind of aesthetic view of the whole matter, which he saw in a completely different kind of proto-Marxist way. And it's a material view of life to see that it's only protein shortage that would get people to become cannibals, you know. That's complete nonsense. But at any rate, my deal with them was that I would have to put a recipe at the end of each of these columns. And so I found a traditional, a very snooty traditional French recipe for something called pain de cervelle. It was a kind of cold soufflé of calves' brains. I mean, that was how it evolved in France for normal eating. But in the ingredient list, I put 1.5 pounds brains of any higher mammal, and the referee was just, they showed me his marginal comments, and he was, you know, like that cartoon image of someone with smoke coming out of their ears. You know, he was very angry, and he said, "I doubt this person could distinguish between the brain of a human and that of an alligator." And so they published it anyway, but then I got taken to lunch by the editor, who said, "Really, you know, you should write about plants." I said, "I don't know anything about plants." He said, "You'll learn." He said, "There," and think about it. And he was right. He said, there are many more plants than there are, mammals that we eat, different variety. It's really much more interesting, and you should do that. So I did for a long time. And then he took me aside and he said, "Now, what you want to do, because you're a progressive person and you believe in this country," I was very flattered to hear myself described that as a discerning patriot. He said, "You want to go out and save all of those regional dishes that are being driven out of existence. Our culinary heritage in this country, we are losing it because of McDonald's and supermarkets and a kind of homogenizing food culture created by the interstate highway system. So I thought, well, sure, I'll do that. And I would go to places. And what I found was that I was going to go out in canoes in Minnesota, in the lakes of Minnesota with Indians and Ojibwe Indians and harvest wild rice. And I got invited to a meeting of wild rice producers, and I thought they'd all be Native Americans. But in fact, they were kind of local capitalists with float planes, and what they had done was this very advanced botanic selection, so that they had created. I mean, the problem with wild rice was that of all the grains around, it was the only one that had not been hybridized the way every other grain had been, so that it could be harvested. What this means is all the seeds have to mature at more or less the same time and not fall off the blade of grass that they're growing on. And that is called non-shattering. And problem with wild rice was that nobody had ever done anything with it in those terms. It had just grown in lakes. The Indians would go through with with canoes and sticks, and they would bend the wild rice into the canoe and beat it, and the mature seeds that were about to shatter would fall into the canoe, and they'd fill the canoe and take it away, and then they'd come back again and do it again until all of the seeds had fallen into the canoe. It was very inefficient, and that's why it was so expensive. And also they used to harvest it by jigging. I saw a demonstration of this. They would dig a hole in the ground and put moccasins and go like this, and eventually it would wear the hulls off of the grains. Well, this was not a way to have an industrial grain supply chain. But these guys with the float planes, they went through and they found non-shattering versions of wild rice, and they selected them and saved seed. And before you knew it, they had done in a short space of time what had taken with wheat and corn and so on. It took a few years, and they had non-shattering wild rice, which you could harvest in a paddy just like rice, like real rice. They're not related, by the way, botanically. But and that completely destroyed the picturesque old world of harvesting, and in fact, the whole industry moved to California. So there, over and over again, I saw that rather than disappearing, these old foods were suddenly gathering a kind of new life, and people I interviewed who were these traditional backwoods sorts of characters and old farmers were suddenly, as I would write about them, it wasn't just me, but you know, they were becoming suppliers for the gourmet garage in New York. And we suddenly had in this country, as you all know because you lived through it, a remarkable resurgence of interest in our foods. And so there was a whole other kind of interest in American foods and American food ideas and specialty products that grew that none of us had ever known anything about when we were, or very few of us when we were growing up. And so we had that world, which I described in many columns crisscrossing the country. And we are all the better for it, of course. And I went into hibernation for a while, and I became a cultural journalist again. And when I woke up in 2006, the Wall Street Journal decided that it should have a restaurant critic for its new Saturday paper. And I came out of retirement, and I went, and because the journal didn't want me writing much about New York or other well-known centers of gastronomy. They made me go to all kinds of places because they're a national newspaper, and they wanted to prove that even in their food coverage by having their critic go to Omaha and other places not traditionally thought of and as centers of high gastronomic culture. And what I discovered, at first I thought this is really mad and I'm going to have to pull punches and write about it. But it turned out that in the 15 or 20 years that I hadn't really been paying attention, American chefs had been taking over the world, at least this world, because they had found high class training in Europe, and then they could train each other and their apprentices, and they fanned out across the whole of North America, so that you could go if you knew enough, you could go to a place called Findlay, Ohio, south of Toledo, and find this one restaurant that was part of the same, you know, culture of American creativity within, you know, under the umbrella of French training and the Nouvelle Cuisine and the historic interest in historic American foods and traditions, and it all would coalesce in one young chef's vision of how to do things. I mean, this happened in Peoria, where, you know, the most amazing place. By this time, there was also a lot of interest in from farm to table, and this place in Peoria, he just leased a farm. I mean, he got this farmer, he hired him to produce food only for this restaurant. So, yeah, I mean, this was real locavore because it was, you know, a short drive down a country road, and you'd be at your farm, and he had livestock, and also he was using all of this fancy machinery. And we are now coming to the vexed subject of molecular gastronomy, which had by then taken over the imagination of a whole lot of people. It was both machinery, new gadgets for the kitchen that would flash freeze with liquid nitrogen and allow, or food chemistry so that you could take olive oil and suspend it colloidally so that it would all actually look like an olive, you know, and you could remake the olive out of olive oil. And there was all this trickery, some of which actually tasted pretty wonderful. And so we had places in Chicago like Alinea, and most famously in Spain, north of Barcelona, was a place called El Bulli. And that was some Spaniard's idea of how to say bulldog, because there was a bulldog statue of one in front of the restaurant. But it was the most advanced and sought-after restaurant in the world. They opened their reservation book in, I think, October, and within 24 hours on the internet, they had 2 million requests for reservations for 800 spaces. For the year, I think, or something like maybe 8,000. But so there in Peoria, they had the anti-griddle, which looks like a griddle, but it, instead of heating, it produces serious cold, and then you can do all kinds of tricks with it that I never have understood myself. But they were doing, then there was sous vide, the most famous machine, in vacuum, and it's a water bath. You vacuum seal, say, a pork roast in a plastic bag, and then you put it in this water bath and cook it for 36 hours, and what happens is very magical, because it becomes very tender and delicious, and nothing is lost. So you get a kind of eerie tenderness and qualities to meat in particular that you couldn't achieve in any normal way theretofore. So it was outlawed, of course, in New York by our health-conscious mayor, who thought that there would be some kind of disease that would spread throughout the alert foodie public. but they finally were persuaded that all over the world people were doing this. And so these places that I would encounter were operating at the highest level of technical proficiency. They were really sophisticated, these guys, even though they had, you know, the kinds of tattoos you associate with people in prison for life. They were really artists, and also extremely clued in, even though they might be living in places you don't associate with high culture, perhaps. I mean, if you're a coastal snob like me, you would think that, you know, Peoria wasn't really going to cut it, but I was really wrong. And it happened again and again in Milwaukee. And finally, I began to think there was no place you could go where there wouldn't be something that was of, you know, national, I would call it of national significance. I mean, if you were, say, a food-obsessed person of even modest affluence, coming from a big city, and you had to go there on business, you could always find a place that would be just as good as what you left behind, or, you know, even more interesting because it would incorporate local things and a kind of fresh view by some young person. And this, I wanted to go to Duluth, Minnesota. The journal wanted me to do a dining guide to the two in the first Obama election. They wanted me to do a dining guide to the two national convention cities. So I was in Minneapolis and on one of those. And I figured this is my chance to go to Duluth, Minnesota, where my friend David is spending 16 years of his life in a federal prison camp. And he had rather foolishly embezzled $12 million from the Indiana feed company that he was CEO of in order to pay for his trophy wife's equestrian habits. And they caught him, and he's still there. So I wanted to visit him, and I thought the way to do this is to find a restaurant in Duluth, so I'll have an official work reason for going up there. And I found this place called Nokomis. You know about Nokomis, daughter of the moon, Nokomis from Hiawatha. And so right there on Lake Superior, the Gitche Gumee, was on the banks, was this very informal restaurant where this man was doing really remarkable things. I mean, it was really a roadhouse, but he had on his menu kind of remarkable little takes, kind of Northern Lakes takes on food from elsewhere. It was just totally charming, and it was a very nice lunch. The visit to the prison was a truly depressing experience, I have to say, but it's not, you know, in one life you do want to visit your friend who's in the slammer for 16 years. So in the end, I started out in what, certainly looking back on it, seems like the dreariest possible assignment, going to these bad restaurants that were closing anyway and reproducing in a glum way, full of snobism, the food of the recent past, or distorting Italian food and, you know, giving you things that no Italian had ever eaten. That kind of scene with a ghastly supermarkets. I once to prove that what a terrible thing, how degraded the public taste was, I got somebody, some magazine, to assign me to go in the height of the fresh produce season to stand in a supermarket and where there were, for once, you know, lots of fresh green beans available, right, you know, in season in one place, costing almost nothing, but they still had canned green beans you know, the worst thing, those with their denatured olive drab color and their horrible taste and vile texture in cans. And I stood in front of those cans figuring I was going to interview whoever was coming there to buy those cans in the middle of the summer and ask them why they were doing that and maybe take them home and cook them a fresh green bean and see what they had to say about it. And I went, it sounds like a really good idea for an article, doesn't it? And the fact is, nobody bought any green beans. So you see, and they were in fact buying, I mean, the canned ones. They bought the good ones. But so the only lesson I learned from this is that people are better than you think, and they, or if you, to prove, if you want to prove something, you should really go take a close look at it before you sound off. And finally, I realized, a person looking as suspicious as I do, you know, stand lurking in a supermarket aisle for 2 hours and nobody paid any attention at all. I could have been the mad bomber, you know, or some kind of sex offender. And I mean, you're just standing there in front of the canned green beans in August. And nobody paid any attention in this vast supermarket, you know, deserted aisle. I don't know what that says, but it was very weird. So I ate in all these remarkable places, and we finally ended up in Copenhagen at what that year had been chosen as the best restaurant in the world. And it was a place called Noma, run by an Albanian Dane named Red Zepi. And he was this very charming genius, I think. I mean, everybody got it kind of wrong, because what he decided was that Nordic food, you know, they have no growing season, and all you could do was forage and preserve and do things that sounded like it was, you know, some kind of ghastly Arctic expedition, and everything would be tasteless, or maybe he was good enough to make it taste good. But you got there, and contrary to all reports, he preserved seaweed, and he found these little fish that they smoked, and they did all kinds of clever things to preserve food in a climate like that. But what he did was to take that stuff and then make totally original, delicious food, and a lot of it was very funny, and especially funny for Danes, who really got all the jokes, because many of these dishes, you know, or the foods were things they ate all the time in one way or another, but which he turned in a kind of comical way. I mean, he put some kind of bread through a small fish, the way, you know, those hats with the arrow going through your head. You know, that's what it, I mean, it was meant to look like that. That was his sense of humor. So it was this brilliant, the most famous dish, I think, was he used 7 different kinds of vinegars to cure 7 different kinds of vegetables, so that if you really had the patience, you could think about them all tasting differently with different textures, but they were all these wonderful colors. And it was like going scuba diving in the wonderful coral reef, because they'd all stand up in this arrangement that was simply fabulously beautiful. Well, I figured we had reached a point with this place that, you know, it was a complete justification of I had occasionally thought was a totally misspent life. And but what I can tell you is that it wasn't glamorous. Maybe the low point was in the winter of 1973, when Vietnamese food was barely known in this country, and you know, we were involved in a conflict there. And so people, a small number, well, there had been no Vietnamese in this country to speak of, but the first restaurants were the Green Beret Training Center in North Carolina. There were 2 restaurants, the first 2 Vietnamese restaurants in America, and they were started by language instructors, Vietnamese nationals who had come over And, you know, this is going, if this story gets out, it will just ruin the prospects for the immigration bill in the House. But they had been brought over on special visas to teach Vietnamese to Green Berets. And then they quit and opened restaurants. And they were excellent restaurants, you know. And so the one opened in New York, and I was all excited. And it was in one of those very long blocks in Midtown. And it was a really cold night. And I got there, and as I arrived at the restaurant, I saw smoke coming out of it and fire engines and the block. You couldn't actually go to the restaurant because it was on fire. And so my friends who were meeting me, I mean, clearly I couldn't review a restaurant from which the staff were being evacuated on gurneys. So that there, I saw immediately, you know, being not stupid. And but the real problem was, I mean, because that my friends were gonna, and you know, I was a little early, and the street was blocked, and it was possible that they were either going to come from the west or from the east, and you didn't know, and you couldn't tell because there was smoke. So I kept walking all around this long block in the shivering cold, finally found them, and then we stumbled upon an Indian restaurant whose great good luck was to get one star in the New York Times. Have I exceeded my allotted time? Do you want to? I should explain why my book is called "Steal the Menu," because when I went to the Times, I had lunch in the Times cafeteria the first day with Charlotte Curtis, the frightening and sarcastic woman's editor who was my boss, and with Craig Claiborne, who was dying to get out of there and go to East Hampton to start his new life. And so I said, Mr. Claiborne, I said, this was after he had complained that in the Times cafeteria, the puree mongol had too much bay leaf in it. And I thought, oh, this is a world I don't belong in. And I said, well, Mr. Claiborne, here I am, new to all this. What advice can you give me? And he said, oh, you'll figure it out. He said, the only important thing is you have to steal the menu. I said, why is that, Craig? And he said, well, because there's all that information in it, and you don't want to be calling them up on deadline and asking how much the hamburger cost. And so if you ask for the menu, though, maybe they'll give it to you, maybe they won't. And if they don't want to give it to you, they're going to be watching you like a hawk. So the only thing you can do is you take, when they're not looking, you take it and fold it up under the table and put it in your briefcase. He said, while you're folding it up, it might look like you're playing with yourself, but no waiter is going to intervene over that.
If you have a question, please raise your hand. We will get a microphone to you. Who would like to start us off? Lady in green right in the center there.
I went to school in the 60s. I don't remember anybody being a vegetarian or a vegan, but all of the girls that work for me in their 20s now only eat vegetarian food, and some of them are even way further than that. And I wonder how food you think or predict will be in the future, because I would have never thought it would have gotten to this level. Not that I don't like vegetables. I want to make sure you understand that.
No, I understand. I once wrote a whole book in which vegetables were the principal ingredients in the recipes, but it was not a vegetarian cookbook. Are these young women, are they what we call sentimental vegetarians? They don't want to eat Thumper? For me, I'd always conceived that world as between the sentimentals and people who had crackpot ideas about nutrition. Basically frightened about food and nervous about it. But this is, I think, a subset of that. where they think they're going to balloon into people they see in supermarkets. Yes. who are as large as their cart. And
they do have an epidemic of obesity, so I mean that's...
Yeah, no. I mean, all of these concerns, and I shouldn't make light of this. I think people are legitimately concerned about cruelty to animals, about things that are done to meat that are probably not good for us, and about the health effects of eating lots of high fat food and so on. But are you concerned that they will carry on with this through life and ruin all your dinner parties?
Raymond, we actually have to move on to the next question, but I think where she was heading was, do you like we see vegetarianism as a food trend now? Is there one that you can predict in the future?
I have been living with, some of my best friends are vegetarians. But I think it's a harder thing for the non-vegetarian. I mean, they do what they want, but when they come to your house for dinner, what do? You know? I mean, you don't want to be rude to your guests, but on the other hand, so if you make, with some people, I do make a special dish of raw kale, and I, no, I don't do that, but anyway, I guess I have no answer to that. I don't think it's a serious major trend to the point where the whole country is eating only kale salad, although it is a modish dish of the moment, isn't it?
Yeah. Another question. Yes, lady in the fourth row here. If you could keep your hand up.
Do you have favorite sources for information about interesting and wonderful restaurants in New York?
In New York?
In New York.
Oh, well, I'd like to broaden that to because there's something I didn't cover. It used to be that the only information you could get was entirely unreliable because people have the strangest taste, and they would send you to restaurants that you just didn't want to go to, and you didn't know who to trust or what. And there were no reliable restaurant guides. Do you remember Duncan Hines? But now there are a couple of reasonably okay national restaurant guides that anyone can look at, and there is the internet, which, apart from, you may think that all of those amateur reviewers and Yelpers and people like that are not obviously trustworthy, but as a crowdsourcing thing, when you constantly see when I was traveling, how would I know where to eat in Milwaukee? And it became clear that if you looked at the five or six obvious places to look for what people were saying about restaurants in Milwaukee and what Zagat had to say and TripAdvisor and so on, all those not perfect sources would eventually coalesce around a couple of places. And a 29 in Zagat really does mean something. A 17 in Zagat is a joke. You'd get led. I mean, you might not like all three or four of them equally well, but if you had to, you had limited time, and you wouldn't trust anybody in Milwaukee to send you anywhere. You know, because look, I would go to places in the 70s, and I'd read about them, and you'd get all these lists of traditional important restaurants in Chicago, and it would be places like Fritzl's that were absurd, and they had their people ate in them, and they had spent a fortune over 30 years eating in Fritzl's, so they'd tell you it was a great restaurant, and you'd waste an evening eating in Fritzl's. So now you don't have to do that because hundreds of people are reporting on this all the time. It's not perfect. And of course you make your own judgment when you go. But there is so much being written now and people are so much more sophisticated that it's to me, fairly. I mean, there was a very plausible summary in something called Time Out New York this week about cheap restaurants, and it had in the middle of it about eight. They had selected eight new ramen restaurants, the Japanese noodle soup. And these were non-traditional ramen, reflecting trends in Japan that have now made their way to New York in small places. And we went, you know, we decided we'd go to all of them. And we went to one, and it was in the middle of a neighborhood of new restaurants that we, you know, whose menus we looked at. So, you know, that's how I would do that. I mean, you know, or when I was trying to find out about, I did a national survey of hamburgers, which is, you know, intellectually absurd. You can't, you know, what are the standards and how do you know, and you can't eat in 4 million hamburger places. On the other hand, if you spend a lot of time reading what people are saying on the net about hamburgers, you really do begin to get a kind of sense of what would be really interesting. And I found this place that was amazing, two of them. You know, just incredible, idiosyncratic places with very delicious but original hamburgers, and I would never have known about them if I hadn't been scouring the ether to see what people were saying. I mean, I went to many other such places that had similar kinds of recommendations that I didn't like at all. But, you know, time is limited, and that was a way of doing it. And also, the huge change that's occurred since 1980 is that almost every restaurant's menu is online, which means you get, you know, all that information that Mr. Claiborne was talking about is right there, often with pictures of the food. And, you know, it's a huge leg up to just being told by some friend that they have a good sauce béarnaise, you know? So that's just the absolute best thing of all are the websites, restaurant websites. I think.
We have time for a few more questions. Would anyone like to ask another? If you'll wait for the mic, sir, we'll get it right to you. Folks, if you could wait for the mic.
I can't.
Will you be able to tell us those two good hamburger restaurants that you found in New York?
What? Oh, you mean yesterday?
Whenever you just ate.
No, the ramen place.
No, the hamburger ones.
Oh, the hamburger. Oh, they're not in New York.
Oh, I've misunderstood.
No, and they've closed actually. But, no, it always happens. You know, I decided when I was at in one of those jobs that I was going to pick the waitress of the year, wait person of the year, and in my neighborhood there was this, you know, kind of relatively interesting restaurant, and and there was this really kind of clever, witty waitress, and I decided, you know, she will be the waitress of the year, and I persuaded my editor this would be a good idea, and then I went back to the restaurant, and they'd fired her.
And so all good things must end. Please join me in thanking Raymond Sokolow. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.